Welcome to the Gold Coast. My name is Nick Cox, and I have with me Steve Tyers.
Hi, everyone.
And we're going to talk to you today about a project we've been involved with for quite some time. There's some friendly faces here. You can see familiar faces. I even saw one gentleman walk all the way to the top of the stairs
and then
disappear into the darkness.
We lost track of him.
So high up there. if you like, you can come down a bit closer and actually see our friendly faces. We've got our Twitter handles up here. There's #MDC333, which if you'd like to send questions to that, we'll answer them over time. The easy questions we'll answer right now. But what we're going to do is talk to you about a project. Actually, we've got some people still streaming in. We might just meander for a moment. But maybe I should introduce myself and you can do the same. That might be a good start.
Sure.
As people try to sit down. I'm the solutions engineer for Citrix in Canberra, and we're in Australia, so at least I don't have to explain where Canberra is. And I look after federal government and defence. I now look only after three accounts, defence being the largest. Defence is the largest agency in Australia for government, and it overdoes the next closest agency by about the size of three. So we're going to talk to you about a project which is about deploying virtual desktops for that agency. And it's a project that's been meandering along for a little while. I've been involved for probably close to 5 years from inception to where it is today. And we're going to walk you through that. Steve?
Yeah, likewise. Look, I guess my involvement in the project is going back actually probably even longer than Nick. Our company, Ubi, was responsible for, I guess, the Department of Defense's first foray into server-based computing. Back then, obviously, Windows Server 2003, R2, Presentation Server 4.5. So it's been a long time. This current piece of work, I'm working on behalf of a big systems integrator, Thales Australia, who are obviously undertaking a lot of this work for the Department of Defense. So.
Okay, so we might get started. And so the reason why I've invited Steve along instead of listening just to me is to have a different voice, but there's a lot of depth with Steve, who's been the chief architect for Citrix for this project. So I brought a smart guy with me to make me look good. So we're going to walk through defence. Let's give a little bit of a brief about the ICT vision, what's trying to be achieved, the project itself. We're going to look at the architecture and a piece of work which we did to validate our architectural designs and what's next. So be ready. It's kind of gets complicated quickly, but we'll try and work our way through it. To start with, the Department of Defense has multiple environments, and right now it's highly distributed across a large number of, they're not really data centers. There's a couple of data centers, and there's broom closets with some equipment in them, which I get referred to as server rooms or compute rooms. I guess like most large organizations, they have lots of small locations that need to service and even stuff under desks. They have a large number of servers, a large number of apps, the 2,500 listed up there is probably underrated. It's probably closer to 4,000 after sort of sniff around. I guess 2,500 of them is core applications that you say, you know, for example, Microsoft Excel will count once instead of three or four times based on versions. But I guess the big thing here is that we're talking about 100,000 users. Some users use multiple networks, so they have multiple devices on their desks. And that's interesting because that complicates our solution. The vision is to basically simplify the environment, bring it up to date, because it's right on the edge of being out of date. I guess like large organizations, it takes a long time to make change. And this has been programmed based on a white paper that was written for IT a little while ago, and where there needed to be savings, it needed to be agility from the platform and the ability to respond to change quickly. The distributed architecture as it is today resists that sort of change, and the ability to do updates, for example, The need to do a security update takes a long time to touch 100,000 machines. So this was a vision that was put forward about, it started with the idea of centralization. Am I centralizing both data and your compute and your virtual desktops, your desktop platform? You have the ability to change quickly and become agile. So it's then about managing endpoints in a light way, light touch. One of the major architectural changes that's coming is called the single information environment. And that's about a concept of going back to more out-of-the-box configuration, stop modifying heavily for the environment, and using the technology that's in the box today. And I guess being a tech head, we know Microsoft technologies well, and we all talk the same language, so the likes of strong GPOs enforcing privileged access versus everybody having high access. There are some fundamental improvements which need to be made. I don't know whether any of you heard of it. Those who are involved in any government will probably come across it. There's an organization in Australia called, they used to be called DSD, they're now called ASD, and they write the security policies to be enforced and governanced for Australian government agencies. And one of the things, they've got a list of 34, I think it is, 34...
Maybe 35.
35? One. But they have a list of 34 or 35 recommendations of what should be done. There are, the top four, though, are about addressing 85% of improving your security stance. And so defence were even challenged with addressing the top four, and so this program's been... is seen to be able to support that and make the environment more secure than it is today. So you'll see Steve and I, we're going to be handing back this thing back and forth. We're going to try and mix it up a bit. I'm going to get Steve to talk about data center consolidation and about the change in the environment.
Thanks, Nick. So the first time I've actually got to use a clicker as well. Quite like it. So yeah, the data center consolidation. So look, as Nick mentioned before, the Department of Defense at the moment, we're distributed across 280-odd server rooms. It's heavily geographically dispersed. We might have two users literally at the back of Burke versus a DL380 sitting somewhere, and then we might have somewhere like Russell offices in Canberra that's got thousands of users. So the differences between them, between the ends of the spectrum, obviously are quite stark. So the future state, of course, is to consolidate down to 9 data centers. With a state-of-the-art primary data center. So, but a big part of this work, obviously, is, as Nick touched on, is the single information environment, and the data center consolidation strategy, I guess, is one piece of that. So underneath that, we've got separate streams of work. Along with the data center consolidation, we've got an Exchange refresh, so moving from Exchange 2003 to Exchange 2010, and again, consolidating down from all these distributed Exchange servers into 9 data centers. Along with that, we've also got data holdings consolidation as well. Obviously, there's a lot of NetApp equipment out there. It's about pulling that data back into 9 data centers, making it a little bit more manageable. One of the other pillars underneath that program of work, of course, is the Next Generation Desktop Project. Now, the Next Generation Desktop Project, obviously, is all about providing desktops once all the data, once all Exchange, once all those things are centralized. And essentially making it simpler to manage, as Nick touched on before, the idea of trying to push out an update to 100,000 machines in a rapid fashion obviously just wasn't possible with the current architecture.
I would add there that we've had the case where there's been the attempt to push out an update. It's failed or taken most of the day to do that while users become unproductive during that period. So there were some really big examples of the challenges of doing a highly distributed traditional desktop deployment.
Yep, that's right. Now, of course, once we consolidate from 280 down to 9, we have to start taking a bit of a look at the network. So a program of work that started some time ago now is essentially taking a look at the network and, I guess, identifying those sites that might need to have their links upgraded. And we're not just talking about upgrading links as well. We're talking about utilizing that bandwidth in a smarter fashion. So obviously we're looking at WAN optimization technologies such as Citrix CloudBridge and the like. The last point on this particular slide is the single desktop, single secure desktop. So most desktops within the Department of Defense, and I'm talking about the physical desktop here for a second, have two computers on them. They literally have, they all have two PCs. There are two predominant networks used, a high and a low. And in most cases, people will have two PCs and then an expensive switch box and then a single mouse and multiple monitors and things of that nature. So if they want to go between the two, they have to basically, you know, switch between them. Now, of course, while that means I'm one user, it means that the defense have to look after two PCs for me. So again, the management overhead there is a little crazy. So a little bit more, I guess, about the next generation desktop project. So it is ambitious. So as Nick said, we're looking at consolidating down from, you know, 2,000 or potentially 4,000 applications, hopefully not that high, down to around about 400. Now, just to give you an example of some of the applications, though, that we're dealing with, which we know we can cross off the list straight away, one of the ones that came up not too long ago was an Ansett travel planner. Now, I'm not sure how many years ago it was that Ansett disappeared from the landscape, but it was certainly some time ago. There should be some quick wins, at least, on that front. Now, the cross-domain technology. This is an interesting one. So for the cross-domain, the solution is using a product from Raytheon called TCS. Now, this product essentially allows us to do away with two devices on a user's desk and instead replace it with one. So essentially, its sole purpose is to deliver multiple classifications to a single device. And it does this with some smarts, and we'll have a look at some of the architecture behind that a little bit later on. The enhanced security and functionality. So again, this is probably going back to what Nick was talking about before, the DSD recommendations and mitigations and so forth. So we're looking at applications or products, I should say, from the likes of Lumentum and AppSense. Lumentum, some of you might be familiar with the previous product that they had called Sanctuary. We're looking at Lumentum device control to, I guess, secure what can and can't be plugged in to the actual endpoints themselves. So it's part of our, I guess, that in-depth security approach. Lumentum, as far as the security function for us, is going to be handling the application whitelisting. Now, that's number one on the top four.
AppSense.
AppSense. That's actually number one. So application whitelisting is number one on the top four from DSD. So it's obviously, it's a very important one. Something that obviously we're not going to go into lightly. It's not one of those things you want to just switch on and keep your fingers crossed, obviously. There's a lot of training and testing involved in order to make those things go live. Moving to the next generation platforms. Now, it was next generation when we started. So we're looking at Windows Server 2008 R2. That's essentially going to be our server-based computing default platform. That'll be dressed up to look exactly like a Windows 7 desktop, so the users essentially won't have any idea. They won't be able to tell the two apart. Windows 7, obviously, we've got some use cases for that, both in the VDI and in the thick client space, and Office 2010. What it does, though, obviously, by centralizing this into a single data center, or nine single data centers, is it gives us a much simpler migration path going forward. So we've got that path to Windows 8, path to Office 2013 and beyond.
So before someone asked the question, why are we using, for example, Office 2010, a lot of it's come down to application support, plugin support, and
Absolutely.
That directed us to a particular version. We know we've got strong support for 2010. 2013 is the target space, but until the plugins that Defense use, it'll hold us back. So.
Yep. Absolutely. And, of course, driving all of this is that standardized ICT environment. So the move, there is a fair amount of synergy between the high and the low networks at the moment, but I guess this is going to potentially go beyond those networks. So it's really just about having a single template that can be applied to both networks. And I might hand back to Nick.
Yeah, thank you. What I'm going to do is just take you through where we're coming from, so what it looks like today is a distributed environment. Windows XP, who has it in their environment? Yep, just about all hands are up. So it takes some time to get it off 100,000 desktops. So we started a little while ago. We have in the defense environment Windows XP as the default desktop SOE. Server 2003 is the predominant type. There is a move towards Server 2008 as the standard SOE today. Office 2003. So this is one of our challenges as a desktop project, is that our application set is quite aged. Between XP and Office 2003, the challenge to move too far forward, like an Office 13, is a big step, hence why we ended up on 2010. And the challenge that comes with it, all the back-end support and a good example, you know, Link and those sort of things, integration. Mm. So we've had a lot of decisions to make along the way to end up with the desktop. And we'll show you a bit of a view of the desktop in a minute. The end of support is certainly driving us towards experience of getting XP out. You know, the cost of custom support is the alternative, and that is very costly on so many desktops. The most important thing is that we've now got an accelerated design, so we're working towards trying to get this thing out faster and faster. We'll just talk a little bit about the networks. When we talk about 100,000, we've got 100. There's a lot of devices on this environment. So as Steve's put, the day-to-day corporate environment, the policy environment, the thing that runs defense, is around the 100,000 mark. And there are other networks, particularly the one that we're addressing, is around the 20,000 of those 100,000 users. So you'll find that there's devices on, as Steve talked about, on the desk, as a percentage of people that have access to the higher network as well. Concurrent login is an interesting statistic. So we're working towards 170,000 concurrent logins. That actually will determine the size of the infrastructure in our data centers to do this. And remember, we're going from 280 down to 9. So those data center infrastructures are getting far bigger than what they are today as we spread out. Log on storm. So there's a peak. I think it's 7:23 in the morning, 7:51 in the morning. There's a certain point in time when there's a peak of log on in defense. And it's interesting that it's pretty consistent right every day that it occurs at the same time.
So those military folk there, early risers, I'm more of a 9:30 kind of person, to be honest.
All right, so this is the functional design. Let me walk you through this. I'm going to start on the right, I think, where there's three users over there. I'm going to see if I can see the words there. So let me talk you through quickly the single domain worker. We've already started talking about this, where, you know, this is the day-to-day policy engine, what you and I would know as, I guess, office automation. And this is a user who will come and do a task-based role. In defense, they're very task-orientated, so this is my job and this is what I need to do today, whether it's either public service or military. And that user we'll see predominantly on the low network. There's also a power user, and this will be a special purpose type of user. One may be doing geospatial work, they may be doing operational support, those sort of things. So today they'd probably have a high-end workstation sitting on their desk with them, so something that's big and powerful, and needs special requirements. Then we've got the multi-domain user, and that is the user that has access to both networks. So they're often military and will be working in both environments. Rarely simultaneously, they'll have a dominance towards one or the other, depending on their workload or their role. But what this does, it determines out the endpoints is up there. I don't need to look backwards, I've got screens everywhere. The endpoints, which is either, and we've basically categorized into, based on their type of role they do, either thick, thin, or a CDS system. So CDS is short for cross-domain solution, and the cross-domain is about having one device access both networks simultaneously. Thin clients, we're taking an approach of, I'm stealing too much of your thunder, am I? Mm. you can tell me to stop any moment.
No, that's okay. Well, look, you're right though, it is on one of the next slides.
So we're talking about thin clients or repurposed desktops, and I'll hold that, how's that?
That's fine.
This comes from a desktop delivery function. And the desktop delivery function is about, we employ a decision-making process based on what the end user's role is, what type of desktop they get. And let's be clear, we're talking about here either VDI, a hosted Windows 7 on a hypervisor, or we are talking about a XenApp virtual desktop. Now, we will show you how these things look the same, but you know, we're leveraging the likes of XenApp 6.5 made to look like Windows 7, and the user doesn't know the difference. So one day they may be using a Windows 7 virtual VDI, and we'll start calling it, between us, we'll call it SBC and VDI, SBC for server-based computing, VDI for a virtual desktop. And we make that decision process on logon. So we determine whether they have access to VDI. If they get, if they're part of the VDI group, they get a VDI virtual desktop presented to them. Otherwise, they will get a server-based computing. Now, applications come from an application farm and environment. That's either from Zenapp or from AppV. Will be streamed into that platform. And the user environment is dynamically assembled and pushed into that user session based on logon. Now, all this has to wrap in. Now, I'll give you a little insight. In pilot, one thing about pilot is they're so hard because you don't get to your endpoint of the end game. You have to integrate with the existing system. And this bar across the bottom here is just trying to represent the extant system, the existing system we need to integrate into. So pilot, we had users from all over defense, and they needed to access any one of 15,000 print queues. So it's a really good example of just how complex the pilot is. Hopefully we'll get to them just having their own 15,000, you know, instead of trying to work between two systems. So I'm going to ask Steve to talk through a bit more of about an IT diagram.
It's a slightly different take on the previous one, I suppose. But
this is one that we all feel more comfortable with, right?
So, yeah, even use the Microsoft stencils, I think. So obviously on the left, we'll just walk through this. So obviously on the left there, we've got Joe User. As
he gets around a lot. You notice he was on the right before?
Oh, yeah. As Nick mentioned before, we've got four device types, but we'll talk about the first three here for a second. So we've got our repurposed PCs running Windows Stim PC. We've got Windows 7 Enterprise, and we've got Windows Embedded Standard as well. Now, insofar as the Windows Stim PC is concerned, the last time I believe Defense had a look at their PC fleet, it was given the big tick that it was capable of that 90% of the PCs in the fleet were capable of running Windows Stim PC. Now, given the fact that a lot of this is about cost savings, obviously extending the PC fleet lifespan by another 2 years, and when we're talking about that many PCs, was a big driver of savings. It got the project off to a good start as far as the business case was concerned. Windows Embedded Standard. So I mentioned that there were 90% of the PCs covered. Now, the 10% that are left, obviously, that's where we'll be looking at replacing them. Now, when we do replace them, we'll probably look at replacing them with Windows Embedded Standard. So we've got that consistent Microsoft feel down on the endpoints. Now, obviously, Windows Stim PC and Windows Embedded Standard, they're fine. What we didn't want to do is have a user log on with a domain credential or with a smart card and then launch a browser and then go into the system and do all those kinds of things. So there's a couple of pieces of software, obviously, that we put down on those endpoints. The first one was Citrix Receiver. That's kind of a given. The second one was one that it still amazes me how few people know about it, which is the Citrix Desktop Lock. Now, the Citrix Desktop Lock essentially takes these dumb terminals and kind of makes them even dumber. So it essentially takes away any GUI that the device might actually have. So a user, once they log on, essentially all they get is a spinning wheel saying, I'm connecting your virtual desktop, and away it goes. So it's that seamless experience from log on all the way through. There's no double hops, no double authentication, none of that business. So the Windows 7 Enterprise, the thick PCs, that's an interesting one. Now, I think Nick mentioned it before, but it obviously has its place. If a user comes to us and says, look, I'm crunching data all day, I need a Core i7 with, you know, 8 cores, all those kinds of things, 16 gig of RAM, there's not really, they don't really fit into the SBC or the VDI space. So we understand that there's obviously going to be a requirement there for giving users a physical desktop as it's required. Likewise, they might have a requirement for a local GPU, or they might have a dongle, or just running certain applications that actually need physical hardware underneath them.
Sorry, if I can interject just one thing.
Yes.
I will make mention that it's probably not obvious, but I'll say it for you. All the endpoints, all the client endpoints are Windows. Okay, so even when we get, we're deploying and replacing devices within clients, they're Windows-based. And there's a reason why. I don't know if you who've done work with thin clients, but when they're Windows-based, you can put peripherals with them and they work. It's kind of a really important point. If you want to put a webcam in that needs a shim, they'll work. They're more high-powered, so they're more likely to do video offload and processing. So, and we also didn't change the security model. security model is still doing domain logon at the endpoint all the way through, so they're managed.
That's right. There's no auto logon to these devices. It is logon from control alt delete, essentially. Now, the fourth terminal that we've got here, of course, is the CDS terminal. So these are the cross-domain terminals. Now, this is the one exception to the rule. These don't run Windows. So these essentially run
a hardened
version of Linux. That's part of the greater Raytheon TCS solution.
But once they boot, they look like Windows.
They do, that's right.
Actually, they are.
A little bit clunky, but nonetheless. So moving along to that next pillar there, which I'm sorry we don't actually have any words around that one. That particular pillar with the two arrows, what that is essentially representing is that's where we have our NetScaler global server load balancing. It's where we have our web interface servers. It's where we've got the Xen desktop and the Xen app controllers. So the brokering components within the solution.
Looks simple with a bar, doesn't it?
What's that?
Looks simple with a bar.
I'm not sure why there isn't a label on it, though. But anyway, I'm sure you would have all figured it out. Obviously, moving along to the next vertical that we've got there, is some mentions of Hyper-V. Now, obviously, the first thing that stands out there is that we've got two versions of Hyper-V in the environment. We would very much love to have one, but at some point during the detailed design, we have to draw a line in the sand as to the various product set that was in use. Now, you can see there where it says Hyper-V Server 2008 R2, that's in that VDI space. Now, the reason for that is obviously we've adopted Xen Desktop 5.6 for the first release. Xen Desktop 5.6 has a requirement that it depends on SCVMM 2012 RTM, which means that we can only manage 2008 R2 hosts underneath it as well. So, but we are looking, we've got a technology insertion plan to address that at a later date in the project. Obviously, stepping down through those horizontals there, the applications and the SBC stack. Applications, obviously Xenap. Xenap is our big means to deliver applications, tying that together with AppV as well. And then on the bottom layer, of course, we've got our RDS services. So thankfully, those bottom two horizontals there, they're all going to be on Hyper-V Server 2012, which is great news. You might also notice that in the top right-hand corner there, we've got Windows 7 and Windows XP listed. So Windows XP is listed there in the event that we actually need to deliver VM-hosted applications. We know not everything is going to run out of the box. That's fine. We know that there are going to be some crap applications that might be 16-bit, or they might refer to hard-coded paths to Office 2003. We've certainly seen it all so far. So it's there as a contingency. And again, on the bottom right there, you can also probably see we've got Server 2003 R2, Server 2008, and Server 2008 R2. So we've got all the platforms at our disposal. Now, having said that, all the application analysis hasn't been completed yet. So this is a design for, but not necessarily with, but the capability is certainly there. So the desktop types. So interestingly enough, a lot of these figures that you see up there, whilst initially not necessarily validated, talking to other people within the industry that have undertaken a project of this magnitude, those figures, the 70-20-10 split, seems to come out and be pretty accurate. The 70% server-based computing, so this is essentially a desktop, Xenap 6.5, 2008 R2, was based on the initial investigation into the desktop requirements by Defence. And essentially, Defence looked at the current applications that they were running on their server-based computing platform on Presentation Server 4.5, and said, right, that covers nearly our entire audience, so we've got a pretty good feeling that we're going to be able to run that on Xenap 6.5 as well. 16-bit apps aside, of course. The 20% virtual desktop, this is an interesting one. So while the design itself has essentially catered for 20% of the total population needing a virtual desktop running Windows 7, and Nick can probably back me up here, during the pilot, we couldn't give it away.
No.
So Nick, what we basically did, and Nick again touched on this earlier, is you couldn't call up the help desk and say, hi, can you put me in the VDI group? It didn't work like that. What we had basically structured was it was purely based on peripheral requirements or application requirements. So perhaps you've got a peripheral that needs full USB port redirection, or you've got an application that when it installs, it listens to a particular port, and that port's assigned to the user, and therefore it can't have a multi-user OS, all those kinds of things. That's what we put into that bucket. So you could call up the help desk and say, hi, I need to access application X that has that, but that application X group was then nested in a VDI group that then gave you access to the VDI desktop. So, which was good because unfortunately, knowing the way defense works, if someone had found out about it, they would have just called up and said, put me in the VDI group, and then our capacity goes out the window and it becomes a lot more difficult to manage.
So the point is that we didn't actually find any use cases in our pilot no. for VDI, which is very interesting because when we're talking about 20%, it's still a big number of VDI infrastructure.
It is.
So, it was certainly a surprise. We actually had to force. We needed to test and load and the way it worked. And so we moved all users across to VDI at some time. So
obviously, look, the 10% thick client there, that's really been put in, I guess, as a contingency. And I touched on that in the previous slide. A user might have a requirement for survivability. They might have where even if the network is down, they still want to be able to access that particular application. Granted, that means that the server backend also needs to be on site. But also GPU requirements, large processing, multi-cores, those kinds of things. Mr. Cox.
Thank you. So this gets up to the fun part, or actually probably the most enjoyable part of the whole project. I left Steve doing the hard work.
I didn't get to go back to Canberra.
And I got to jump on a plane and go to Redmond. And we went across to the Microsoft EEC, the Enterprise Engineering Center. Anybody heard of the EEC? Some of you? So EEC is offered typically for database work, validating database sizes and things like that. That's most people familiar with EEC. It is the most impressive data center I've ever seen. It is there was a picture up there I took. The red lights can change to different colors based on a system center console that can go out and show, for example, hotspots in the or which servers are doing XenApp or which servers are doing database. So it is amazing, and they use swipe cards to get in and out of the racks, and it's extremely impressive. So what we did, the reason why we got over there to take cool pictures was because we were working there, and what we were doing was validating what we committed as a cost model and the assumptions we were making around density, particularly for SBC and VDI. One of the questions we constantly asked ourselves was, should it be a VDI only? And that's why the pilot surprised us, because while VDI is the talk of the town, it's the thing that everybody talked, certainly 12 and 18 months ago, should everybody be doing VDI? And here we proved out ourselves to ourselves that SBC was the strong use case. One of the things which is really interesting is that we constantly prove to ourselves that SBC has about twice the density for sessions or users per server than what VDI has. There is a significant cost that goes with VDI that SBC halves. So it was really important to prove it out. The other thing is that we're using a stack that hadn't been used before. And so we got to do it in this cool data center. So what we were doing was basically rebuilt the pilot in the EEC, and that actually means taking what we're working with. We worked with our scalability team. So there's people in our organization that write the reference architectures. I've got one of them in the room with us today. And if you went to his session yesterday, the things that Steve was rattling off, like VM hosted, actually Tony exposed us to yesterday. But this team, their primary job is to work with the HPs, the Ciscos, the IBMs, the Dells of the world, the vendors to write the reference architectures and give you papers on how to build this stuff and with density numbers in it. So we use them to help us achieve some scalability results on the stack we were working on. So you can see there, we made some assumptions and guesstimations based on the reference architectures that had been done. And we were aiming for about 80 virtual machines per host and about 180 SBC sessions per host. I'll talk to you about what's in those hosts, but those numbers were, they're still pretty high, quite frankly. And when we're talking about the workloads, including applications, not just the desktop itself, it's really important to get this number right, because defense's workload is particular to them. So one of the things that often gets missed out are things like antivirus. So we put that into our stack for validation. So here's a list of the components that we use in the Microsoft stack. Now, we talked about Hyper-V, and we call it Hyper-V2 because Hyper-V3 was coming in 2012. So Hyper-V2, which is SP1, we're using AppV at that point, 4.6. We know that Zen Desktop 7 will bring us to AppV5, and so we're playing a strategy towards that. Defense currently, in their current, we talked about current state, they use a large amount of ZenApp streaming. Certainly, I think it's one of the largest in Australia deployments. And so for them, it was a significant architectural shift and skill set shift to go from all these streaming packages to this. So that's an important point for us there. Now, the next one, System Center. System Center 2012 RC. So this is why we had to go prove the stack. Okay, we were using a release candidate of System Center, and we're using it particularly most valuably for VMM and SCCM. So VMM was the critical thing that changed for us because we didn't, there wasn't enough testing done because it was RC at that point about how many VMM servers we needed, because that could play out really importantly particularly for the VDI architecture. So there's a clear direction and architecture in this project about System Center 2012. And so proving out VMM in this capacity was really important. And we used some clients you'll see there at the end. The Citrix stack was ZenApp 6.5, ZenApp 5, ZenApp.
And we've got a flavor of everything,
right? And that's because of application support, right? We do have 16-bit applications in the environment like every enterprise does. And we needed a way to deliver that. So ZenApp 6.5 is our SBC platform, though. Zen Desktop 5.6, because we are talking nearly 12 months ago in this cycle. AppDNA was used for validating applications and what targets they could live on. NetScaler is used for, we'll talk a little bit more about some of the use cases for NetScaler, but it's about transparency of failover and also direction across to home data centers. We haven't really talked about that, I'm not sure we will, but...
We will.
We will? Okay. Into that, and CloudBridge. So these are all, we're talking about using basically everything in the stack. So actually, that's not even a whole list.
No.
It's nowhere near a whole list. So this is probably, anybody who's talking about density, interested in what servers are we using. So in this case, Defense prescribed the actual servers that we're going to use, which is actually created quite a challenge for us. Because
at least the vendor anyway, in this particular case.
Yeah, well, they prescribed to us a box that's normally used for database, and that's not quite the appropriate box we use for VDI and SBC workloads. But it was based on an IBM platform, a Blade platform. And so this is what we took into the EEC. Well, we used the EEC to test it out. So HX5s with local SSDs, it's something we made a change. We wanted local SSDs for where we write the provisioning server write cache for the desktops, whether it was SBC or VDI. We tested both 128 gig and 256 gig of RAM to see what the results were, whether we increased our density. I'll come back to that. Or will you go to that? it was a 20 core with hyper-threading, so that was enabled. And at that point, we were using an EMC VNX for the back end for beyond provisioning servers capacities. This is what it looked like. And I need to explain, it's kind of done the way around, right? So here's a picture of an IBM Blade chassis, and we used three servers for workload, three hosts for workload for VDI, another three for SBC. The rest of the platform was made up of infrastructure, SQL, a dedicated Blade for Active Directory. Let me just go back there. And the reason why, we actually were basically trying to work out what was the workload across three servers for VDI and what was the workload across three servers for SBC. The rest of the Blade was just made up of, you don't need to have five blades for infrastructure to do this.
No, right? Left. Having said that, this was just the pilot build. It certainly wasn't what was going to be taken forward.
So. Yep. So this is not what our design ended up looking like. This is the way it was tested. Right. So this is my favorite picture. I don't know why.
Is that because you took it on a Mac as opposed to a Windows machine? Yes.
Well, I live the dream. I live in a Mac every day, and I use my virtual desktop every single day. So... I'm not shy about that. I use Microsoft product every single day. So this is the Windows COE. And we call it COE. Other people call it SOE. This is the platform. The reason why it's COE, COE is Common Operating Environment. And this is why. This platform, what you're seeing here, is based on a Windows 7 platform. Okay. To make it work with Zen Desktop, it requires a virtual desktop agent. But it's the exact same look and feel for the desktop that runs on R2, 2008 R2, which is ZenApp 6.5. Okay? So the users, no matter which way they come in, look and feel exactly the same. That was a really important design point. As when they use a fat desktop, they will look and see exactly the same. It won't be any different to them. Now, here's the stack. So you can help me here. Okay?
Sure, I'll chime in.
So the dynamic profile management is done by AppSense. And with the reason, there's a couple of reasons why we used AppSense. One of them is because we had 9 data centers and we needed the user profiles to be accessible from anywhere. And they've got a database backend. Versus using our own user profile manager, which has a file system that needs to be replicated. So easier to replicate.
And look, likewise, the number of platforms that we're dealing with here obviously meant we could either go with 5 different profiles for 5 different platforms, or we could use AppSense to do some smarts, importing certain settings and so forth.
So we enlisted their help because this is what they do as their core business. Okay, so folder redirection.
So this was an interesting one as well. So look, I guess early on, probably post-pilot, a decision was made. Obviously, we had a very powerful product in AppSense Environment Manager at our disposal. What we decided to do, though, was to actually keep the Microsoft native group policy engine for the out-of-the-box settings for Microsoft policies and use AppSense for, I guess, the more group policy preference-based kind of settings. So I guess that's why I just wanted to have a quick segue on this one, because folder redirection obviously ended up in the Microsoft stack as far as group policy was concerned, not in the AppSense side of things.
Yep. Application for performance management, particularly for ZenApp. That's the AppSense tool to manage make sure it doesn't exceed and run over. So there was some value in that space. We saw some density increasing. Antivirus. This is a great debate, wasn't it?
The decision was made really easy. Is anyone familiar with Project VRC at all?
Everybody.
Tony, thank you, Tony. So Project VRC, if you haven't checked these guys out, they do white papers on everything VDI and SBC related, whether it's single server scalability, whether it's Office 2010 versus 2013, SCEP versus other products, all those kinds of things. Now, this particular decision was made really, really, really easy for us. We were already going down the system center path. We were quite happy to go down that path. And obviously, we had system center endpoint protection as part of that. Now, which particular product came out top of the pile as far as the testing for Project VRC? System Center Endpoint Protection.
Is that right? And it's a click button to make it work.
Yes.
Inside System Center.
That's right. So that was a really, really positive outcome.
There is a little story that goes with this. We were at Redmond, and we did have a problem with SCEP when we did testing. You know what? One phone call, and the developer's sitting there looking at it, and he said, yep, tweak, 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 done. And that was built back in. So, you know, there's high value with working with partners, strategic partners such as Microsoft. And when you've got problems like that, they can pull on the right people to make magic happen. Application whitelisting. We talked about the top, number one on the hit list for ASD. And application whitelisting is done by AppSense. Device control. Steve spent a bit of time talking about Lumentum device control to manage the insertion of USB and that sort of thing. So you see the stack is actually getting quite complicated. This is just our desktop, right? And remembering, we are talking about running it on Windows 7 and 2008 R2. Foundation apps. Office 2010 is probably the easiest example of a foundation app.
Yes. Okay. Now, most people probably refer to these as core applications. Yep. Microsoft, during the design, thought that we came up with Foundation, that Citrix came up with it. Citrix thought that Microsoft came up with it. So I'm not sure who did come up with it. So, but Foundation stuck.
Yep. This is all coming from a provisioning server standard image. So one golden image through provisioning server onto Hyper-V VMs, and we can scale out using the provisioning server. So that's our base image.
Correct.
Say?
That's right.
Our COE. AppV delivers streamed applications for business apps, and the ones that don't work so well with streaming, that come from backend, maybe 16 bits, a great example of an app that won't fit that profile, comes from a ZenApp farm. Okay? So there was a lot of thought that went into that to get it to that point.
Yes.
And a lot of design. So that's my prettiest picture of the whole thing, sorry. It only gets worse from here. Although I do like the shiny speed thing. Well, we did testing, and quite frankly, Hyper-V proved itself. This was a great debate because the incumbent hypervisor was not Hyper-V. And so there was a preference for using that hypervisor, and we saw the benefit in the cost model, the scaling, also the simplicity. You saw our stack a second ago, keeping out another tool set in that desktop to make it work. It's one less thing that we needed to support. SCVMM, RC, performed really well. So it was another validation point that we were on the right track, as did the SBC and VDI platforms. So we were working with what we were proving out that we could work with the sizing we're talking about, to the point that we actually achieved our goals, our targets, which is a good thing. We're allowed to come back and not find new jobs, but we exceeded them. So that proved the cost model was valid and that there was savings to be made by increasing density. So I'll just written them in there for you. So remember we were targeting for VDI 80. We proved out over 100 on that server platform. And what was I saying? 180, I think it was, for SBC, and we proved over 200. Now, I'll say that this point is that since this time, you can't buy that hardware anymore. There's been a refresh and moved on, and the numbers have gone up again. So again, lowering the cost per desktop and the number of servers involved to deliver this infrastructure. So Steve, the hard work. That's why I brought the smart guy with
the hard work. Well, look, some of these are kind of not really hallelujah moments, but let's take a look at some of them. The first one, virtualization is disk intensive. Certainly, particularly for the SBC and VDI workloads, there's certainly no surprises there that came out of it. I guess what it did solidify for us was a decision to move towards solid-state storage, local solid-state storage, as opposed to shared storage for these hosts. Keeping in mind,
I would say when we were doing this, this was a new concept, right? What we were previously looking at was building very big SANs with lots of fast flash in them.
Exactly.
And so we were trying to look at a way of making the project cost effective so it would go ahead.
That's right.
So this is a really important point that we started. And our reference architecture team, our scalability team, sort of headed us in this direction.
Yep. That's right. And look, we certainly haven't looked back. I mean, I guess for us, and for the way defense works, the workloads are essentially, they're non-persistent for a start, both the SBC and VDI workloads. We also don't need things like live migration. So again, we didn't really have too much of a need to go down that shared storage path. 200 gigabyte SSD wasn't big enough. 5 years, we probably wouldn't have been saying that. We would have just been happy to have one. Certainly what we ended up with, though, is we didn't have any problems with IOPS. So we had anywhere between 50,000 to 100,000 IOPS per disk. Obviously, there was a RAID penalty because we went with RAID 1 for some high availability. But still, we were not coming anywhere near it, even when we were throwing 90 virtual machines or 100 virtual machines on top of those hosts, which was great. The problem that we did run into, though, and this is obviously why the testing didn't really go above that 100 mark, is when we're delivering it in the fashion that we are, you can see the term PVS write cache there, and I can understand that not everyone's necessarily familiar with that. So provisioning services is a really, really important part on how we're actually going to be delivering all of these virtual machines, and we'll touch on that a little bit later. But essentially, each virtual machine that we're then using provisioning server to stream the operating system into, it needs a little cache drive. That stores the deltas just while the machine is running. So once the machine reboots, the deltas are gone. There is some data that we get to persist on there between reboots, but as far as those delta files that are basically created during runtime, they're essentially obliterated every time the machine reboots. More RAM. No, that's exactly right. It did increase density. And in fact, it would have actually played against us anyway. So the underlying platform that we're using here, you've got to remember, was Server 2008 R2. What comes with Server 2008 R2 and VDI?
Bin files.
So we would have had to get really, really big. Now, having said that, what we did end up with in the current platform, where we're looking at HS23 blades, is we've got two 800 gig SSD drives per blade. So we've got a fair amount of storage to play with.
So I'll make the point, if it's not clear enough, that the HX5s only accepted 1.8 inch SSDs, and that limited the size they came in. So going to the refresh platform for that, we have some new choices for drives.
That's exactly right.
800.
So obviously the next stage was the module design. And look, a lot of people who might have dealt with Citrix reference architectures in the past, this will look very, very familiar. We've got the layered approach of the access, the control, the desktop, and the provisioning, essentially. So starting at the top, and obviously Nick was talking about this earlier, we've got NetScalers. The NetScaler was a very, very core piece of this solution. You can see there in the diagram that we're talking about GSLB specifically in this particular case. So what NetScaler GSLB was doing for us is essentially allowing a device on a desk to have essentially a home data center. So GSLB, a user would log on, and GSLB would then kick in and go, right, where's this device's nearest data center as far as latency is concerned, and all these other factors that need to be taken into account. It's that decision process there that says, right, well, your nearest data center is 100 kilometers down the road, the other one's 1,000, let's go to the 100 kilometer down the road data center. So that's great. We straight away then get sent into the control module. And the control module, I guess the front end of it for us, is the web interface. The web interface is what plugs into all the components that sit underneath it and controls all the brokering. To the left of the web interface, you can see the SQL database mentioned. So each data center out of the 9 will have a SQL, highly available SQL cluster running on server Hyper-V Server 2012, virtual as well. So obviously that was a very big key difference from the pilot build, where initially we're being steered away from virtualizing SQL. Citrix licensing, of course. Citrix licensing isn't available in every data center. We've actually got 2 licensed servers. So moving down the stack, as I said, you've got the web interface server that's plugging in to the various Zenapp and Zen Desktop controllers that sit below it. Those particular components, obviously, sitting underneath them is the virtual machines on the hypervisor layer, and then we've got our provisioning, where we've got our Zenapp images and our Windows 7 images. So as I said, there's certainly nothing new to that particular design approach.
So can I get you just to... One of the greatest logic things we needed to work out is how do you get a user to their home data center?
Yep.
And GSLB won't do that alone. They'll just direct you to your nearest data center, for example.
Yes. So that was a little bit more complicated. But again, we didn't have to do anything too out of the box to enable that sort of functionality. When we're talking about 9 data centers, and we're talking about Zen Desktop, and we're talking about Zen App, things probably get a little bit more complicated, at least in the Zen Desktop space. It's nothing insurmountable, but given that we're combining the two and users have home data centers, I guess there were some additional things that had to be considered.
Because the user's only sent to either their home data center
or one
backup, right? They
and
can't
in fact,
go to anywhere.
No, that's exactly right. In fact, I'll cover that later on, so I'm glad you asked.
Sorry, there we go.
Provisioning services, PVS, probably one of my favorite products. I really love this product. So all of this is not possible without provisioning services. So essentially what provisioning services is allowing us to do is essentially single instance management. So you can think of provisioning services like a PVS server. Think of it like the hard disk, the network, like a SCSI cable, and then you've got your virtual machine or your machine. So basically, we're creating a gold VHD, we're sticking it up on the network, and then we're telling that virtual machine you're going to boot from that VHD that's sitting on the provisioning server. And this means essentially we can have single instance management across various operating system platforms. So once we go back to provisioning server, we then say to provisioning server, can you go and create me 5, 50, 500, 5,000 machines that can then take that VHD that you've put up there on the PVS server? So it's a pretty powerful tool, and obviously taking the opportunity to implement provisioning services, seeing as we're consolidating into data centers, kind of made a lot of sense. In this particular diagram, imaginatively called a Type 2 module, simply because there's 2 blade enclosures, essentially in this particular diagram, you can see that we've got the subnet A and the subnet B. Now, in this particular case, all that's really trying to demonstrate is that we've got 2 provisioning servers within each blade enclosure, virtual, I'll add, and essentially those provisioning servers will look after the virtual machines running within that enclosure. So there's about 513 virtual machines as far as VDI and SPC is concerned within each enclosure. So certainly we can have one of those PVS servers fail and have no problems. We can actually have both of those PVS servers fail, and then they'll actually go and get their disk from another PVS server within a couple of minutes, which is pretty handy. Yes, that's a very busy diagram.
But it shows the complexity we're dealing with.
It does. So PVS, I guess, is something that doesn't really lend itself to the WAN so much. It is a data center specific service. Given that we're talking about data centers from, you know, somewhere in Perth to the Northern Territory to Queensland, we couldn't have a SQL server sitting in the primary data center and then basically having all these different PVS sites hanging off it. It just wouldn't have worked. So what we do have, what we've ended up with essentially is a PVS sole, PVS farm per data center in this particular case. Now, in this particular image, the big farm that you can see there on the left, essentially, so that's the largest PVS farm in this particular, for this particular design, and this is just for one of the networks. So just to put it in perspective, that has 20 PVS servers in that particular farm streaming to 5,000 virtual machines and supporting 20,000 concurrent user sessions, just with 20 servers.
Wow.
And that's all using the same images.
Okay. So this is before you click on.
Yeah.
There is one other partner that was really important to overall management of this, and I wanted to, it's probably a good point to stop, because this is a great example of the complexity of the environment we're working with. And it was kind of like a late entry to the design. And for systems management, with SCOM, Systems Operations Manager, was a really important piece of keeping track of what was healthy and what was not. And so we used Comtrade management packs for keeping visibility of what was healthy, what's not. They have, if Citrix alone doesn't provide visibility of things like provisioning servers, you need something else to understand and monitor whether they're available, whether they're responding, whether they're down. And Comtrade provide a really good Zen desktop. Under Zen desktop we call these days is Zen app, provisioning server, web interface, all those pieces. They have plugins for all those people, management packs for all those pieces to give us visibility, and that's really important for operational support. We simply can't do it without it. So System Center being such a key piece to the overall infrastructure, the management packs are a key piece for that visibility.
Yep. Now, we'll add, this is the small network as well that we're dealing with.
This is true.
This isn't the bigger one. So we've started small, we'll be thinking
big. We have tried to simplify it for be able to talk about it?
Yes, absolutely.
So
let's just, we'll talk about Zen Desktop a little bit. So with Zen Desktop, I guess the Department of Defense, we already had some evidence from the pilot. Now, the pilot said, probably going to have a hard time giving VDI away. We haven't found too many use cases for it. That's fine. And then look, this applies to the defense environment. I'm not saying VDI is not for anyone. now, what we said to the Department of Defense was, okay, well, We need to know a little bit more about your users. We need to know which bucket they essentially fall into. And they said, well, look at your hardware. Look at the hardware platform that you've got. Look at the testing that you've got out of Redmond. Go to the best practices, and you know what? Whatever gets spat out the other side, that's good for us. So basically, it doesn't sound very scientific, does it? but what it ended up with was actually, as far as VDI is concerned, it ended up with a pretty highly spec'd virtual machine. So we've got two vCPUs. The RAM actually, this is just a recommendations from Citrix. The RAM actually was about 3 gigabytes. So we've got 3 gigabytes of RAM per virtual machine, two vCPUs, and of course, and then that write cache as well. So it's actually ended up to be a pretty generous configuration. We didn't need dynamic memory management in the end. Again, we were able to carve up just what RAM was available. Each blade had 256 gig of RAM, so we just basically were able to carve that up. So it's actually worked out pretty well. In fact, sorry. I ate my words there. It was about 2.5 gig of RAM, not 3 gig. But still, nonetheless, pretty impressive. Given the fact that we had that this was Zen Desktop 5.6, obviously sitting on Hyper-V 2008 R2, we did have to deal with the bin files. So that was 2.
We don't need them. That's the point.
That was
right?
200. So that was 270 gigabytes of SSD that we couldn't use.
Yeah.
So I can't wait till we move this entire stack to Zen Desktop 7 and Hyper-V Server 2012.
Very shortly.
yes, so VDI is easy. Just look at this diagram. So this was the Zen Desktop modular design. And again, I probably don't need to dwell on this for too long because it's kind of been covered in some of the previous slides. We've got a Netscaler GSLB sitting at the top. It's performing functions such as GSLB, as well as server load balancing, as well as content switching, which we'll come to that in a little bit. We've got our SQL, we've got our web interface, we've got our Citrix licensing, the Zen Desktop controller below that, and then, of course, we've got all our virtual machines and the provisioning.
I think the point here is that we did plan for Windows XP as VM-hosted apps, which is why XP appears up there. We hope never to need it, but at the moment, it's there as a mitigation for application.
Absolutely.
Delivery.
Now, with the exception of Citrix licensing in this picture, essentially this was then cookie cut in every data center. Now, the exception to that, and it's the reason why we don't actually have a specific XenApp slide in this particular presentation. Now, the reason why we don't have a specific XenApp slide is because XenApp essentially is sitting across all data centers. So whereas we've got unique and discrete Xen desktop sites per data center, and that's largely due to its reliance on SQL, we don't have follow that same approach for XenApp. So XenApp essentially has a highly available SQL cluster in the primary data center. That's then mirrored to a backup data center, but we essentially just have a single farm across the entire environment. So again, it's slightly different architecture, I guess you could say. So, Mr. Cox?
It's my turn, isn't it? Thank you. So, I get to talk about, actually, I get to have the fun stuff, don't I? Talk about SSDs and blades and memory and things like that. So let's talk about, this is probably, there's a point to make, this is a bit of an eye chart. There's only one line of this thing which is actually very interesting. It's actually the line that says Citrix Provisioning Server. And I just draw your attention because everything else is the same. The only thing that needs to happen as we scale out is the number of provisioning servers that we deliver in a module. So we've been talking to you about modules, and we're talking pretty diagrams with provisioning servers and bits like that. This is how it translates into scalability modules. So I'm about to walk you through probably a diagram. It's probably easier to visualize this. But the point is that to get greater density in a module, when we have data centers that who have more users as their home data center, we just increase the number of provisioning servers to do that and the number of hosts delivering those workloads, so the VDI or SPC. It's
now,
really that simple.
Now, I will say here, essentially, as we mentioned earlier, the whole type and then a number, realistically, it just represents the number of chassis. So in this case, the number of IBM H-series chassis. Now, the reason why we stopped at type 5, there were two reasons. One was we didn't have any single user group that was actually big enough with all the users feeding into a data center to warrant anything bigger.
Yep.
What validated that for us, however, is that essentially we had those five chassis spread across three racks. But once we started introducing more chassis, we then started having to make changes at the network layer. So instead of having this full aggregate of 160 gigabits, we started having to carve up things and of that nature. So the approach from that point was to stack type 5 modules,
yep.
if we needed
yep.
capacity.
So let's show the folks at home the modules. So those of you who prefer infrastructure pictures, here's one. So this is a type 1 module. And the one is, as Steve mentioned, the number of chassis. So this supports 1,920 users. So roughly nearly 2,000 users based on the numbers we planned for. So I haven't written it down, so you can't see it, but I'll tell you that we've done our validation on server-based computing, supporting about 210 sessions per server, per host. This is made up of, from memory, 6 virtual machines running XenApp 6.5.
7.
7.
Yep.
See, I've got my smart guy with me. VDI is, for a VDI blade, they're going to run 90 users or desktops per blade. So when we stack those numbers together, and remember we go back to the assumption of we're going to run 70, 20, 10, or in this case, actually what we do is so we say 70 and 20.
Yep.
Right? That gives us our workload, and that's why there's a color difference between them. So the blue ones are infrastructure. So example of infrastructure, XenApp data collectors, provisioning servers.
Yep. Config manager.
Web interface servers. Yep. Those sort of things are in blue.
BBS.
The next color, which kind of looks kind of orangey, is your SPC blades, and then the pinky sort of color is your VDI blades. So we got that under control. One chassis,
yep.
about 1920 users. Two chassis, or type 2, is about 4,000 users. Type 3, 3 chassis, 6,000 odd users. And type 5, 10,000 users. Now, what's really cool about this...
Why don't we have a type 4?
Right, because we're about to talk about it, right?
Because we didn't have the user numbers to warrant it. So we could have created a type 4, but to be honest, given the number of users feeding into the various data centers, that these numbers fit, a type 4 would have just been additional work.
So I'm just going to go back a bit. Steve was very excited when he came and told me this. Right. How many blue blades are there? 2. How many blue blades are there per chassis? 1. 1. What's important about that, Steve?
Provisioning server.
Provisioning server.
Correct.
If now, I asked a Shazzy,
yes,
then I could still support the rest of my user base.
Absolutely.
Even though I've lost a whole Shazzy. Pretty rare to lose a whole Shazzy.
It would be. Yep, that's right. Now, of course, they do represent the infrastructure cluster itself. So, yes, it's all the workloads, not just the provisioning services that
are running. So, these interconnected Shazzies? Seen as a single entity? Or are
no,
these...
top of rack.
Right. Top of okay. rack. So, you see, we've built a small building block that we can build out. Now, we have a site, a data center, that has multiple type 5s in it to achieve the workload for that the users closest to that data center. So, it makes it much easier to scale out when we work with these type 5 modules, type 1 modules. Actually, type 1 is actually over-provisioning some of our sites.
Indeed, right? It is.
We have some data centers that actually will handle a lot less than 1,000 users. All right, it's back to the hard stuff, Steve.
The hard stuff. This is the fun stuff. So, NetScaler. GSLB, LB, CS, probably most of us are familiar with some of those acronyms. Global Server Load Balancing, which is just the boring server load balancing, and content switching. So this was an interesting one because I guess to make the user experience strong, we needed NetScaler. So basically with this, and I described it partly earlier, we've got GSLB making that decision on a device basis, what's the closest data center to the particular device. Once we get into the data center, I guess that's where server load balancing and content switching come into play. So server load balancing, everyone's probably familiar with server load balancing. You have two servers or more of this that perform the same function, and you put a NetScaler in front of it, and you say, just load balance those servers. And it does that very, very well. Content switching was an interesting one. So I guess where content switching comes into it was we kind of needed NetScaler to go, okay, well, I'm going to load balance these servers here, but I need to make an intelligent decision if both of them are unavailable and to switch to actually a different data center. So it's the NetScalers in each data center aren't necessarily just looking at services within their own data center. They're actually also looking at some servers in other data centers as well. Now, the servers at which they're looking at essentially will follow our failover mechanism. So there was a requirement put upon us that in a failover scenario, we basically needed to be able to support the single biggest data center being able to fail over to a failover data center. Now, that failover data center was then scaled to support its day-to-day user load in addition to that biggest data center.
Now, does it make it bigger than the biggest data center?
What's that, sorry?
Does that make it bigger than the biggest
data center? It was, yes. Right. It did end up that way. So that's a lot of capacity to build into the solution for failover. But failover obviously is a requirement for most people. Two data center failures, we didn't actually have to do that. Once they started seeing dollar signs, I think that pretty much put that story to bed. But nonetheless, an entire data center going offline and then providing a capability for people to still continue working was obviously very, very key in all of this. And it was NetScaler combined with web interface and some smarts built into that enabled all
and
those scenarios
to
occur.
One of the things we found is that if we used NetScaler to do this piece of work, that the failover would occur immediately versus some of the other mechanisms.
Good point, Nick.
Because it's real time. It does every assessment on every link.
Yeah, that's right. So I guess some of the things that we found was when we weren't utilizing content switching to handle this seamless failover, people would log onto ThinPC or they'd log onto WES, and then they'll get a spinning wheel, and it would sit there for 4 minutes, maybe longer, if there was a data center unavailable on the back end. So it was kind of like WI was going, oh, look, I'll just give it a bit of time, we'll see how things go. But 4 minutes just is not going to cut it for a user. So content switching makes the XML services that Web Interface talks to always available. And it really played nicely into the failover scenarios, which did get pretty complicated, but that worked really well. So the way forward. Rolling out with the technology insertion plan. So I guess this was something that was given to all the vendors.
Sorry, I'll just put that into English. And a technology insertion plan is a migration plan, right?
Yes, okay.
So defense speak.
Right? Was this a defense term, was it, this one? The tip. So the technology insertion plan. So obviously we had a lot of vendors involved in the creation of this design. We had IBM, we had Microsoft, we had Citrix, we had Lumentum, AppSense. The list kind of goes on. Actually, that's probably the full list, but... And I guess what we did is we wanted to have an idea of where the product sets were going. So we wanted to know, if we put in this product today, how are we going to get to that product tomorrow?
So there's some good examples of this, right? So server 2008 R2 SP1 for Hyper-V is a good example.
Yep.
And we put that there. We place a Citrix that requirement because of Zen Desktop 5.6.
Correct.
Requires SCVMM, RTM. But we really wanted to deploy server 2012 as the host platform for everything, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
So we needed a way and demonstrate a way that we're going to go from what we're delivering today.
That's right.
To what's the next change.
So Citrix provided us with how to get from 5.6 to 7 and so forth. And it was a very worthwhile exercise. And what it also means is that, as I mentioned earlier, we're doing the small network first. This is the dress rehearsal for the big network.
Yep.
What it means is that we can revisit those things as we go. There's no surprises there anymore. So we can pull out components and put new components in. Windows Server 2012 host standardization. We touched on this a little bit before. No more bin files.
No more bin files.
That potentially means we can have even more Windows 7 virtual machines. We probably wouldn't touch the Zenapp side of thing, but we could potentially have a few more virtual machines running on for VDI, which would be great. So potentially even greater density there. I guess Nick touched on System Center 2012 Ops Manager and the Comtrade Management Pack earlier. As he mentioned, I guess something that we were caught on the back foot with during the pilot, we had a bit of Ops Manager doing infrastructure. We had EdgeSight in some cases doing Zenapp and Zen Desktop, but it didn't give us that whole environment. So Defense were very, very keen to have this whole single pane of glass across the entire environment. Comtrade auto-discovered it. It tied in PVS, web interface, NetScaler, CloudBridge, you name it. And we could even tie in the Hyper-V hosts that sit underneath all of it to have that real
visibility.
It
works differently to EdgeSight. Everybody's familiar with EdgeSight. It doesn't have local,
that's
local
right.
workloads. So,
obviously, the remainder of this particular slide, Appv5, we will be keeping Appv4.6 for legacy applications. AppDNA will be making that decision for us, so we're not going to create two packages automatically. We'll only create the package we need, depending on the operating system it's going to be delivered from. Office 2010 with a path to 2013. So that's kind of a no-brainer for us, and Link 2010 and 2013 sort of falls in that bucket as well.
So we're up to our last slide, guys. Thank you for hanging in there. It's a bit of a talk fest. No demos, unfortunately.
No.
Let's just wrap up what we were doing. This was all about driving down costs and increasing the agility of the defense environment. And that's really important for an organization that is highly distributed, particularly its ICT, and particularly for its ability to be able to implement change. This was all driven over a five-year plan, and the cost savings are quite drastic. So there's lots of this in the public domain about the cost savings that were planned. And I'd say that it's in the hundred of million dollars sort of mark.
Mm. So especially the operational costs.
Yeah, ongoing support. Yeah. So this gives them a path to go forward. So when they're ready for Windows 8 or Windows 9 or even 10, they can do that versus, particularly because of the virtualization layers, the way we dynamically assemble desktops gives them that ability. But it instills change, particularly as the organization changes. Mm. We're about to have a new government or not. You know, these sort of things actually make organizations change, particularly in the government space. So those sort of things have effects which you've got no control over. Extension of the desktop is something which really validated the cost and the long life of the machine. So
we have 1 minute, Nick.
We do, and I'm about to wrap up. So I'm going to get to the Microsoft side. Make sure you fill out evaluations. Remember, be kind to us. We'll be invited back, and we can do some demos next year.
Yes, demos would be good.
These slides will be up on the Channel 9 resource. And I will add that if you have questions for us, we'll either be around outside or to Twitter hashtag MDC333. Thank you for your time. I appreciate you. And don't forget the evaluations.
Thanks very much, everyone.
Thank you.